Good morning. Another tumultuous week for geopolitics. Where to start? Well, what about the Rearm Europe plan? On Thursday, European leaders met for an emergency defence summit. Here's EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen with an outline of what's being proposed.
This is a watershed moment for Europe. And Ukraine, as part of our European family, it's also a watershed moment for Ukraine. Europe faces a clear and present danger, and therefore Europe has to be able to protect itself, to defend itself, as we have to put Ukraine in a position to protect itself and to push for a lasting and just peace. We want a peace through strength. And this is the reason why I present today to the leaders the Rearm Europe plan. The Rearm Europe plan provides up to 800 billion euros for defence investment. It gives the member states fiscal space to invest in defence. It gives the member states possibility to invest in the Ukrainian defence industry or to procure military capabilities that go right away to Ukraine.
So, a rearmed Europe at a cost of 800 billion. Joining Sarah on Drive Time, Labour MEP Eoin O'Riordan, who described the atmosphere in Brussels.
Well, I share Billy's analysis of the nervousness in Brussels. Colleagues of mine from Eastern Bloc countries or those with a memory of Russian aggression, it's not very distant in their history as to, you know, this sort of emotional remembrance that they have, memory that they have of living under Soviet occupation or under the Iron Curtain. So if you're a representative in my own group, which is the Socialist and Democratic Group of the European Parliament from Hungary or from Poland or from Lithuania or Latvia or Estonia, this is very real to you. And we've come to the conclusion that the US have now gone rogue and we cannot in any way depend on them as we have been depending on them or have the understanding that we had with them for the last number of decades is now gone. They have withdrawn, you know, military aid to the Ukraine. They've withdrawn intelligence sharing with the Ukraine, and now we can only, assume that Europe now has to have very, very deep and troubling conversations with itself as to where it goes from here. Now the announcement.
And what's your own view on that? Where do we go from here?
My own view is that what we have to assume that this is only going to get worse. I hate to be a pessimist, but I can't find an optimist anywhere in my circle or anybody else's circle who feels that the next 4 years of the European conversation are not going to be dominated by militarism, by defence, by security.
Oh my. And earlier, Cormac had put this to French Senator Ronan Le Gleut.
I just wonder if what Donald Tusk from Poland has said is correct. He said that militarily and economically, the EU can beat Russia. But Russia, I know from reporting from the BBC, they no longer view Europe as a major force. Could the European Union beat Russia if it came to it?
Well, it's not that we have to be able to beat Russia. The point is that we have to be strong enough so that Russia don't even imagine attacking Europe. This is the reason why we have to rearm Europe and to show that we are getting together. And then there is another debate, which is nuclear deterrence. France already said from the General de Gaulle that the vital interest of France could be even larger than strictly the borders of France. Mm-hmm. And what is the real game changer is what Friedrich Merz, the future German chancellor, said a week before winning the election in Germany. He said that we have to open a discussion for a protection under French and British nuclear deterrence. It is the biggest game changer in defence and security in Europe since the Second World War.
Now, the EU also voiced support for Ukraine, but that statement was agreed without Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, an ally of Mr. Trump who's also working to develop ties with Russia. So what does Vladimir Putin make of all of this? On Morning Ireland yesterday, Anya spoke to Yuliana Pavlova, a journalist covering Russian affairs.
What's Russia's view of the new European push on defence spending and also France offering other European nations to come under their nuclear umbrella?
Well, quite predictably, Russians are quite unhappy about this. And Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov even said that Russia will not enter a new arms race that was proposed by Donald Tusk. But Peskov also said that Putin finds this militaristic statements made by European leaders to be regrettable, especially those coming from Poland and France. And he said that the problem with Europe is that it has not yet adapted to the way that is now being proposed by Moscow and Washington. And then he says, and I quote, "Europeans are very flexible, sometimes excessively so. Therefore, it cannot be ruled out that they will sense which way the wind is blowing." So, you know, they're basically having more swagger now that they have Trump in the White House. And Europe is struggling to show a united front with Hungary refusing to sign on to Europe's unwavering support for Ukraine. So even coming from the Russian foreign ministry, they said that the Macron's nuclear rhetoric posed a direct threat to Russia. But I just want to remind everyone that the Kremlin has been saying this for a long time. They have been using the nuclear blackmail argument since the beginning of the war. So the fact that the foreign ministry says this now, they have been throwing this argument around for quite some time.
From Morning Ireland yesterday. And of course, all of this in reaction to that Oval Office clash, quarrel, showdown. Take your pick. And then on Tuesday, the US announced its pause in military aid to Ukraine, a move that accelerated everything. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Audrey got this analysis from Suzanne Lynch, Associate Editor at Politico.
This is Ukraine's worst nightmare.
It certainly is. This news overnight, it looks like the disastrous meeting on Friday is still having these repercussions, and Donald Trump is not backing down. So this is a nightmare situation for Ukraine as they face this. It also comes at a time when Europe was trying to pick up the pieces and fill some kind of a gap and try and get these negotiations between Washington and Kiev back on track. Now, we do believe that that is still happening. Figures like Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron, are trying to restart discussions, if you like, between Zelensky and Trump in some way. We've seen from Kiev, they're saying he still wants to sign the minerals deal. Some people I've been speaking to here around Brussels are confident that this will happen. However, this new escalation overnight now puts yet another spanner in the works. And yes, it's very bad news from Ukraine because it is so dependent on US aid.
And then, in quite the turnaround, Volodymyr Zelensky said he was ready to work under Trump's strong leadership and that it was time to make things right. President Zelensky's team will now travel to Saudi Arabia next week to meet with US officials. Unsurprisingly, President Trump is feeling confident.
I think what's going to happen is Ukraine wants a deal because I don't think they have a choice. I also think that Russia wants to make a deal because in a certain different way, a different way that only I know, they have no choice either.
Meanwhile, here at home, we prepare for our visit to the Oval Office on March 12th. But a diplomatic disagreement. Tánaiste and Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Harris contradicting a US account of a call between himself and US Secretary of State Marco Rubio on whether our trade imbalance was discussed. Ox. Well, yesterday Claire put this to Scott Lucas, Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute at UCD.
Well, I suppose the one thing, Scott, it tells us is that the trade imbalance is very much on their radar. If you have somebody who's putting together that readout, which ultimately will end up in the papers, we're all reading it this morning and analysing it. Trade imbalance for them, we know now, is front and centre.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, I think we need to put that into context, which is when you talk about the trade imbalance, Ireland has a substantial surplus with the Americans. I think it's around about 50 billion euros in terms of goods. If you were to factor in services, U.S. services that Ireland takes in, it actually swings back in the American direction. But the problem here is that the Trump people don't really deal with that complexities of that trade relationship, and they don't look at it as a win-win situation. And the real problem here is beyond Trump and the public side of what happens, when the Taoiseach visits. It's going to be those private meetings, because you'll have Irish delegations there, you'll have the Trump administration officials there. And when you have a commerce secretary like Howard Lutnick, who is very much on record as saying that Ireland is ripping the United States off in terms of hosting American multinationals, in terms of that trade imbalance regarding goods, what's going to be said behind closed doors? Are we going to get threats from the Trump people? Or are we going to get some way forward where we can have the Irish people saying, look, there is no need to treat this as a win-lose situation.
Mm-hmm. Scott Lucas with Claire yesterday. But your Trump has only gone and declared March Irish-American Heritage Month. So it all might be grand. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Seacht na Gaeilge, we are slap bang in it, and no better time to take a look at An Gluaiseacht, the Gaeltacht civil rights movement which came together in 1969. It featured on the History Show on Sunday, yes, back for another season. And a new book by Ronan McNamara tells its story. And in an unusual turn of events, this was the tipping point.
A rainy Tuesday night in Connemara at the Hotel Chac Furbo. And what's happening is an episode of a popular television programme is being recorded.
Thank you very much indeed. And welcome once again to Quicksilver, our musical maestro, Norman Medcalf. So there he is.
Stop the lights. That's the theme, obviously, of Quicksilver, the TV game show hosted by Bunny Carr, broadcast on Televis Éireann from the mid-1960s all the way up to the early 1980s. During the episode recorded in Connemara, a group of protesters gathered at the hotel to make their voices heard.
So what exactly was going on, and why, as Miles put it,
what did they have against poor Bunny?
Indeed. But it wasn't so much Bunny as this aspect.
RTE were coming to the Connemara Gaeltacht and recording a show in English and not in Irish or with any reference to the Irish language. And this was the cause of the protest.
But really, this was symptomatic of a wider neglect of the Western Seaboard and the Gaeltacht areas in particular. And taking their cue from the more militant Welsh language activists and then Radio Free Derry, they set up their own pirate radio station.
So a number of attempts were made then to get hold of a transmitter. A small group went over to Wales, as it happened, but the Welsh pirate radio station transmitter owners deemed Gluaiseacht to be not respectful enough, not of the kind of Conradh na Gaeilge mould, so wouldn't hand over their transmitter. There was an attempt to purchase the transmitter that Radio Free Derry was using. That failed. But a young UCC student called Michael Healy, or Micheál Ó'Héalaithe, who when he was 16 in 1964 set up one of Ireland's first pirate radio stations for over a week while he was in secondary school, called Radio Juliet, and actually which led to them receiving a coverage on the front page of the Evening Herald and Radio Éireann getting a court order in order to shut them down. So Ó'Héalaithe was very interested in this notion of Sea Radio Connemara and came to Galway as part of a visit by UCC to a drama festival and met up with the Gluaiseacht. And essentially he built, himself and a friend, built the transmitters themselves. And over the Easter in 1970, the transmitter was set up in a caravan, initially in Rosmuc, and then brought down as the Gardaí became aware of the location, moved it to Chiaruruá, where they had the first probably Irish language outside broadcast, with the Cayley being broadcast on Easter Sunday. And after that, then, you know, there were letters sent to the department.
And perhaps no accident that a Radio na Gaeltacht was set up so soon after all this, street legal and broadcasting, in 1972, keeping the Teanga Beo on the airwaves. From the History Show. And with Brian O'Connell, Sean O'Sullivan, a.k.a. the Kerry Cowboy. He's a language planning officer in Cara Savine and a bit of an online sensation, and he is on a mission to get everyone learning Irish, especially if you're new to the parish.
Tá grúpa ana vascaithe in Uber Green, we have a very mixed group. In terms of languages today, how many languages have we in the room? We have Gaelic anyway, Irish, Beerla.
And bad language.
Bad language.
Spanish.
Spanish. Dutch. Cadala. Francais. Hungarian. All in a room in Carsavine drinking coffee. Our goal is to pick up a couple of fuckel. Marana Cadine and saw loads of people here. They have it at cool in the keen. They have it at the back of the head. And we got to bring it out. Do you get Delia?
Yes, my agweet.
Could I start there?
Come on. Gonna start you with him.
Come on, about.
Tell me a little bit about yourself, Delia. How long are you learning Irish?
I've been learning Irish for 2 months now. It's a great way to connect with the people, and they always say every language is a window to someone's mind and culture, and it really helps you to see and to connect with people on a deeper level.
Was there any phrase particularly that you have liked in Irish?
Well, it's a beautiful language. Tán, Teanga, Gohalin.
Tell me about where you're from.
I'm from Palestine, from Gaza, Palestine, and I also know the, like, I really appreciate all the efforts going on in regard to the solidarity with Palestine and Ireland, and also I think learning Irish for me is a way of solidarity with the Irish movement for reviving the language.
Delia is amazing, the progress she's made in 2 months. Even when you asked about a phrase there, I thought, just that's a challenging question for anyone. But to come out with Tán, Teanga, Gohalin, with only being in the country this long, is incredible. And you see in shops, Dalia and her classmates using Gurav Mahagat, Slánga Fóill and all that. And you can see with the shopkeepers and local people that they're taken aback at first, but it reminds them, you know, to use their cúpla focal as well. It's often said about South Kerry that there's only a thin veil of Beerla, a thin veil of English over the Irish that's being spoken here anyway. So it's amazing to see people come from other countries and to go straight to the root like that.
Putting it up to the rest of us. With Ray Gormano, agus an Scannon, Trasna Alina. And writers Niamh Bryson and Heather O'Sullivan were pushing the envelope on the cúpla focal.
A lot of the things in the short are actually directly taken from Niamh's experience in school.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that creative.
Yeah, no, no.
No, but the premise of the say is funny because you play Emma and she arrives and she claims to have, she wrote in her CV, she could speak Irish, which you was a prerequisite for working in a Gaelic school.
Yes.
But she is told a lie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's where the comedy comes from.
And their film has just won the Best Irish Short Film Award at the Dublin Film Festival. So yes, in the last few short years, there's been a massive turnaround on the Teanga.
We like us on Zoom during COVID in bed, writing the first draft.
So. It takes a long time, doesn't it?
Yeah, really
well,
does.
We've had it like as well in different formats. So we wrote it as a short, then when we wrote it as a short, we were immediately told, this isn't a short, it's a pilot.
Yeah.
Wrote it as a pilot, and then I suppose like, obviously, the unique selling point of it is the language.
Bilingual.
Like, bilingual aspect of it. And a few years ago, that just kind of didn't sell. Like, that was kind of like a hard thing, I guess, to understand.
But
also,
now we're Colin Kuhn, Kneecap. Yes,
exactly.
Yes,
like, we literally pitched this to Virgin Media the week Kneecap came out, which was definitely
helped us.
Good timing.
Oh, God,
Trasna and Alina writers with Ray. Ah, the Teanga, the heritage. We love it. Just don't go here.
It's Barry. Barry, good afternoon.
How are you doing?
It's a noble campaign. It's an honourable campaign. It's about time someone stood up. But can I break something to you gently, Barry?
Go on.
Before you tell the nation what your campaign is. It's too late, Barry. It's over.
What?
Your campaign is lost. Your campaign is lost. It's gone.
If it's a good enough campaign, it's a good enough campaign.
Well, tell us what is your campaign, and you tell us what your campaign is, and I'll tell you why I think it's over.
Joe, Dream Crusher Duffy, and at the very start of the programme, tickety talk, it'll be a long time till three. So just what was going on?
There's no such thing as St. Paddy. There's a St. Patrick.
In a world gone mad, this is a campaign we can get behind. St. Patrick's, not St. Paddy's. In fact, Barry invoked the equally important Irish mammy to make his point.
You even take an Irish mother, and she never christens her young lad St. Paddy, St. Packy, St. Pat, St. Paddy. He's christened Patrick. And no matter how many people are around him, call him other names, nicknames or things like that, he'll always be Patrick to her and her son.
Ah, but as Joe told Barry, the good ship Patrick, well, that ship well and truly sailed.
Are you sitting down, Barry?
I am.
Okay. Have you time to get a cup of green tea just to steady the nerves?
I will.
Okay, because I'm going to read out. Just in the last few minutes, I Googled Country Living, which is a very estimable magazine in the UK. This is their headline on the 25th of February. Brace yourself, Barry.
It says celebrate
St. Paddy's Day with a homemade Irish meal. Are you ready for more? Come from the UK, from the home counties. Come to the home counties of Ireland, the closest we have to the home counties. Greystones in County Wicklow. Yeah. What does the Greystones guide say? Greystones.
If he says Paddy, I'll get him excommunicated.
It says Greystones Paddy's Day. And not only that, but they have stickers with Greystones Paddy's Day. Okay. Love in Dublin, which is a widely circulated magazine here in the capital. Yeah. Brace yourself, Mary. Ten Paddy's Day events to check out.
That is disgraceful.
Well, there's more to come, Barry. That's why I think it's over, Barry. The campaign is over. Galway Bio, Paddy's Day in Galway. Okay?
Joe, it's not Paddy's Day, Joe.
Well, hang on, Trinity College.
Yeah.
Tens of thousands lined the streets of Dublin for? Go on, say it, Barry.
I can't, I'm not. It is an abomination. It's too big.
Trinity
too
News.
Big. Joe,
tens of thousands.
Am I swimming against the tide of convention, Joe? Am I wasting my time, Joe?
You are. You were hoping to swim up the Liffey. I think you're being dragged to the Isle of Man at this stage.
They're absolutely shameful. Shameful. Because there's no such thing as Paddy's Day. It was St. Patrick. To commemorate our national state.
Poor Barry, he's going to be scraped off the floor. And for him, though, this all went back to a time when Paddy was a bit of a loaded term.
When I went to England first, I worked with Aer Lingus for 20 years. And that is worse. You get introduced to some English guy, they knew no different other than this. You know, your man is, oh, and the first thing they say out of their mouth is, Paddy, how are you? Yeah. You know, be gar and be jays, let's have another pint of Guinness. That was their summation of what I was of being Irish was at that time, Joe.
Fair point, Barry. And Joe, as always, feels your pain. And then, because Liveline's Liveline, this.
What do you think of Barry's argument? Do you think it's too late? The campaign is over. It's lost. Gone. Well, finito.
It's completely wrong.
Okay,
because it's never St. Patrick. Because for a start, he's not a saint. Because to be a saint, you have to do two miracles, and he never performed a miracle. His name wasn't Patrick.
He's a saint by tradition.
No, and his name is not Patrick. Yes. His name was Zukot.
Oh, good luck. Zukot.
And the reason he was called Zukot, he was Welsh. Oh. And the reason he was called Patrick is because he was a patriot. Which is a person who promotes religion.
So we should be saying. So, what should we be saying?
Saint Patriot.
Well, we shouldn't actually promote him because he came to Ireland to get rid of all the snakes.
Yeah.
The Druids of Ireland.
That's only a story.
But Paul, what are you saying is a proper name? Okay, Paul, what is the proper
Zukot.
Name? Zukot. So it's Zukot's Day.
Well, if you want to promote a man who killed all the Druids in Ireland.
See what you've started, Barry. We'll finish with this.
Barry, what were you christened, Barry? What's on your birth cert, Barry?
I was christened Francis Finbar Anthony.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. The book is called Twist and it's by Colin McCann. He spoke to Brendan at the weekend. And it takes us deep down into the ocean where hundreds of tiny fibre optic cables lie on the ocean floor. And they carry all the data from the internet up and into our screens. Yes, all those memes, those clips, that content. And if these cables break or rupture, Well, the repair is surprisingly lo-fi.
The fixing of the cables you portray in the book, and I think people imagine this is probably a very sophisticated operation, it's a fairly basic, haphazard kind of endeavour, isn't it?
It's actually as basic as the very first cables when they went from Valencia to Canada. What they had to use deep in the ocean was a grappling hook to run it along the ocean floor, hope to find it, hope to bring it up, hope to connect the two ends together. Because nowadays, yes, close to shore, you can fix it with a diver or a remotely operated vehicle, which is a robot. But a little bit out from shore, more than 2 kilometers, when it's more than 2 kilometers deep, you're in, well, deep water, as they say. Yeah. And you have to use literally a rope and a grappling hook to find it. And then it's a cutting grapnel that they use. And then they bring it up and they fix it on board a ship way, way out at sea. It's really incredible.
How many ships are going around fixing cables?
There's only 50 of them. And that might sound like there's 50 in the world, but there's 400 cables. And at any time, there's really only 20 that are fully operational. The others are in port or they're being fixed. And so if somebody decided that they wanted to mess with us, a couple of boats out at sea could do some serious damage.
And of course, all of this is about connection. We've never been more connected. But our ability to focus, not so good.
Well, I don't know about you, but I go on the internet and I jump around. And after about half an hour or about 40 minutes, I suddenly realize that I've gone down several different rabbit holes and none of them had to do with my original excursion. Now, whose fault is this? You know, I can't start blaming Google and Meta and all these things because part of it is my fault as well. So if I can get aware of this, and if we start telling each other stories about this sort of connection, and we can figure some of the things out, maybe then we can confront it. Because, you know, the technology's there. We're not going to ever get rid of it. But is there a certain way that we can use it powerfully so that we can actually truly connect with one another and make it into something that benefits us? There's always a desire to make things better,
but we are nothing if not messy, and all too often online complicated ideas and motives are distilled into easily digestible bite-sized bits, which does the world and us all a bit of a disservice.
People are going to argue as well that we're maligning the cables here, but that, like, all this modern communication has democratized things. More people have a voice. We've seen, say, what's happening in Gaza like never before, from all the people in there having the technology to show us stuff. We saw inside Ukraine, continue to see. We see what war is in a way that we never did before, courtesy of technology.
You're absolutely right. And the thing about all of this is that you can have a truth and then you can have a truth on the opposite side of it. And then the scientist Niels Bohr actually talked about this. And you can have a truth on the opposite side, which is also a very deep truth. And I think the problem is that we're not prepared to hold two opposing truths in the palms of our hands at the same time, because it can't. And this is what's wrong, say, with politics, and this is what's wrong with the way, you know, you see the world going and all this stuff that's unfolding awfully in front of our eyes, is that the contradictions are gone, the messiness is gone. And one of the beauties of life is the ability to be more than one story, to be more than one thing. And I do think that the technology is incredibly powerful. And yes, we know what's going on in Gaza now. And yes, we know what's going on in Ukraine. And it's awful. And we can feel it. We can empathetically feel it. At the same time, we need to be able to get in touch with ourselves in order to be able to, you know, expand the world in different ways and change the things that are going on, not only within ourselves, but then hopefully in Gaza and other places by being concerned and being properly engaged.
Colin McCann with Brendan. And on Arena, Julie Delpy, who spoke to Sinead Egan. Now, Delpy directs and stars in Meet the Barbarians, a film which features a small community in France preparing to greet refugees, who turn out to be from Syria. And because it's a comedy drama, Delpy made this really interesting artistic decision.
I think I had in mind that I will not show the images at all. From the beginning, I wanted to see the reaction of people in their face, because I think once you show the images of people dying under bombs and stuff, it's like you can never go back to a comedy tone.
And because in this scene, the Syrian family, the Fayyads, are showing images that they have filmed in Syria, that the situation that they are fleeing from, isn't that what it is?
Yes, it's exactly what it is. The character of the sister, Alma, shows basically at one moment her husband died and she lost her leg. And so it's a very, very poignant moment, because we see the suffering that she has in showing it, and that she feels sad that she has to show it for people to show empathy.
The sound is terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, it was really to grab people, because, you know, in a way, images nowadays, we've seen so much of people dead, mm-hmm. children dead, children torn to pieces, that I think we're getting numb. Mm-hmm. And I found that to express it through the sound and the point of view of people and even children watching it, I just thought it was more powerful, and at the same time not crossing the line of not being able to go back to a film that has a lighter tone.
Julie Delpy on Meet the Barbarians. But you can't talk to this woman without asking about Before Midnight, Before Sunset and the now classic 1995 romance Before Sunrise.
We really, Ethan and I, put everything we had about romanticism in it. And, you know, and I mean, I put things from my journals when I was 18, 19, when I was falling in love for the first time. You know, it was in my journals. Some of the dialogue about the space between, and all the dialogue that is romantic, really, because the original script was not really romantic. They wouldn't never meet again and stuff. It's very different. And, you know, I put everything I had of romance in it, right? In me as a young woman that was really romantic. I was really romantic at the time. And not that I'm not anymore, but not the same way. Let's say I'm very in love with my husband, but it's not, I don't have the same projection. I mean, when you're 18, 19, you have this pure energy of love, right? Which is like this kind of idealized idea of romance. And I was very pure. I was one of those people that, you know, I had my first boyfriend really late. I was like really a romantic. Like I was not a very, you know, kind of, I was very shy. I was very romantic. So I think I put all of that in it, and Ethan did the same. So, and then Richard coordinated everything. So I think the combination was really about capturing those two really young people, very idealist and dreamers, and I think we put all of it in it, and that's what's left. And I think it's still speak to people in a way, for that reason, I think.
Julie Delpy on the classic Before Sunrise, as heard on Arena. And all this week, while it may be called With Love, Meghan, not a lot of love for the Duchess of Sussex's new Netflix lifestyle show. Here's a taster.
You see where our rainbow is coming together here? And you don't have to do a big platter of this. You could do this with one small row for your kids for breakfast, genuinely, and it makes the morning a lot more fun. But can I just show you if you just made one?
Just a plate, yes.
Just a little morning plate. It's a real delight in being able to be a present parent. And it's a luxury sometimes, because we all have to work. We all have a lot of stuff to do, but when you can take a minute to just...
Saturday morning.
Yeah. Finding the fun in those moments makes for a really sweet start to the weekend.
Maybe it does. On the line for Drive Time, TV critic and broadcaster Scott Bryan.
I don't know why, but I'm protective of Harry and Meghan. And I don't know why that is. So I'm glad you're not in the bash Meghan bandwagon, Scott.
No, I mean, I don't think this will change anyone's mind about her. I think those people who don't like Meghan, I think, won't find anything in this show to maybe change their mind. But at the same time, those who have been a follower of an admirer of her work, because, of course, she used to run a website called The Tig, which was also a lifestyle work around the time when she was in the drama Suits before she met Prince Harry. I mean, they'll find some stuff that they would like here.
So, if you're into proper place settings for brunch, you may like it. And if not, well, to quote the great Tay-Tay, the haters gonna hate, 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 hate. But this takedown of the Duchess is even coming from those on Team Meghan.
I saw some of the reviews from Variety magazine, and now they had Meghan on the cover in October 2022, and they said, "With love, Meghan is made with a great deal of love, in the sense that the greatest love of all is the one a person has for herself." And then Time magazine, 2021, they said Harry and Meghan were icons in its list of 100 influential people. And they ran the headline, "Netflix with love, Meghan is a royal primer on entertaining that couldn't be more boring." So she is losing fans in influential places.
She's not. No, she's
not. I mean, I think...
I've just given you two examples.
Yeah, from
Time magazine and Variety magazine.
From a certain section of the press in the UK.
No, but that's not just the
and
UK.
And also, yeah, who roll in with the anti-Meghan bandwagon because
that's my point.
Of
these
the
are not the anti-Meghan
the
bandwagon. These were people who
Will
ran
you just bear with
articles
Scott for
the,
one second here.
But they did. They ran articles in the past saying that these were icons. These aren't the anti-Meghan bandwagon.
Yeah, you'll always have people, once the monarchy takes a position and holds it against Harry and Meghan, who will rail against Meghan because they want access to the monarchy, perhaps.
Yeah, but that's not these people.
But
that's my
well,
point.
Well, I don't know. Is it Scott?
Poor Scott.
I mean, my take on this is that the fact that we're having this conversation, this debate, is music to Netflix's ears, because I think that's what they want, is the fact that this is a show that has been, you know, dominating for news for more than 2 days. And of course, with limited previews, was leading to a lot of speculation about what could be in it. So I guess Netflix are happy, but are they happy enough with the amount of people watching it for them to actually recommit? That's something we just don't know yet, and we'll find out quite soon, I think.
Yeah, I suppose the question is, will all the coverage lead people to tune in? And if they do tune in, if it's as boring as people say it is, will they continue to tune in? And therefore, how will the figures go?
But the clip we played was good, wasn't it?
No.
Yes, it was.
It wasn't.
Hold on now.
I wouldn't watch that. I have a limited amount of time to watch things, and I would not watch that.
You're just jealous of Meghan. It's quite clear.
I'm jealous of Meghan. I am,
Scott, isn't it quite clear that, I mean, you pointed out...
And all of that to bring us to this.
I feel sorry now for Meghan now, this morning.
I do. I feel sorry for her.
Because it got absolutely torn to bits in the British
lacerated.
Media.
Lacerated. Yes.
But is she doing Lent, though?
You know it, baby, black tea all the way. But she would be doing well to beat the sacrifice of Bernard O'Shea.
Do you know what I checked up about Lent?
Right.
Do you know what? It's not in the Bible. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Lent is not in the Bible. There's no mention of it at all whatsoever. Fourth century, the Roman Catholic Church decided, lads, let's do this Lent thing, right? Of course...
But was there not a mention of 40 days and 40 nights
there
in
is.
The desert?
Well, yes. Jesus went into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, and thousands of years later, it resulted in people like me giving up, you know... Red
Crisps.
Lemonade for 40. But this year, right, I'm giving up phone usage. I'm sick of it. I'm going to do an hour every day on the phone.
So that you're not giving it up.
Well, I can't give it up, Ray, because I have to do the Instagram to sell the tickets.
Yes, of course.
Right, and so and I pay for things on my phone. I've tried to give up the phone before.
Yeah.
So it's an hour a day, right?
1 hour.
And did you know, Ray, I've got a little fact for you on each one.
Right.
Right, did you know that that the average person checks their phone how many times a day? Go on, give a guess.
Oh, God, I don't know, 500 times.
96 times. What are you doing?
In related news, online shopping, sayonara, baby.
I'm done. I'm done with it.
I wouldn't have put you down as an online shopper.
Oh, my God. I'm just a terrible man. Again, the phone. And I go, do you know, 4:30 at night, going, yeah, I'll buy that life-size inflatable llama. The kids will... It's like, why do I... Like, you know, I've got... My house is full of plastic crap that I'm never going to use that I bought on Amazon. And it's like, that's it. Amazon, out of my life.
Yeah.
Right? Just leave. Just go, right?
Also gone, negative thoughts.
Oh, here's my fact. How many thoughts does a person have, an average person have in a day?
Well, I got that so wrong the last time. I don't know. 1,200.
6,000.
He is also going to give up sugar, booze, but not continuing to ask Ray questions on statistics.
On average, how many kilos of sugar does an Irish person eat per year?
Oh, God, I have no idea.
24.
Right. You see, I don't know if that's a lot or not.
I don't know either. I just hope Google is right here. And then Ray, finally, I don't drink a lot, but I do have the odd drink. And my problem with alcohol is when I start, I just can't stop. Right. Do you know what I mean? So one point is like, I could never do the one point. It ends up on a ferry to Holyhead buying a horse. So like, I just have to stop, right? I can't do one.
There's Bernard O'Shea off to buy a horse again.
like
Bernard, are you not taking on too much? Like, that's four.
It's only 40
things
days.
Yeah,
it's only
four things. Would you not just do one thing well?
No, Ray, because I've given up just doing one thing at a time, right? For Lent. I'm going to multitask the crap out of Lent. Like, it's going to be those five things: the phone, the online shopping, the negative thoughts, the sugar, the alcohol.
Oh,
but
yeah,
I definitely
would not
stop going to comedy gigs, especially Castle Bar.
Bernard O'Shea, it may be a long 40 days and nights for you, sir. Now, later this afternoon, those pesky French, not our Julie Delpy, mind you, but the rest, we need to trounce you, demolish you, destroy you. May you drizzle your weak, watery tears into your escargot. It's the Six Nations. Des, put it up to Donal Lenehan.
Are you going for an Ireland win?
Very difficult to call. The bookies have France as favourites, and I can see why. But listen, home advantage. We've beaten France in the last 2 years. It's a massively emotional day with the three lads, Cian Healy, Conor Murray and Peter O'Mahony, finishing up. I'm hoping that the emotional wave from the Aviva may just get Ireland over the line, but it's going to be very difficult.
Let's look for a better answer. Oliver spoke to Irish rugby international Fiona O'Brien.
There is very nervous excitement about this match.
There is. Listen, it's been touted as the title decider. And at the moment, Ireland are slim favourites. But as we learned when we spoke last year, Oliver, where I predicted Ireland would have absolutely no problem squashing England and Twickenham, the beauty of sport lies in its inherent unpredictability. And look, that's why we tune in. And I think ultimately this game is just so difficult to predict. And I'd argue, look, that the best attack are going to win.
OK, we've won three so far. Not all of them convincing wins. How dangerous are the French, Fiona?
Wildly.
Wildly, she says. Maybe so. But we have some supporters up our sleeves. People with commitment, passion, intimidating talent. We give you Kevin.
Oh, I went all like this.
I'm not sure what that was, but that was kind of amazing in its own way. Kevin Burke.
And that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And this was the RTE Choice Music Prize Irish Song of the Year, The Spark.